give her some recognition for that gorgeous version of Amazing Grace. Where did that come from? Will you tell me where that came from?
It's Terry Bradford, gospel singer.
Oh, I like that. That was so perfect. Good morning. Welcome to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living. I'm Reverend Karen Rice. Still, imagine that. And I'm really happy to be here on this gorgeous kind of damp morning where we get a little variety in our weather. And oh, it feels so good. It feels so good. So I'm happy that you are here. I have something important to talk about. But I, you know, it's really funny that I keep forgetting that you're healing something. And I just want to tell you that this teaching works so beautifully. Would you like to tell them how beautiful this teaching works? That she asked me to pray for this procedure she was going to have, and I kept sending her like, oh, today's the surgery, and she kept going, no, it's not. And I kept affirming that it was done, and she said, this, how did you say it, Sue? It's like, I love that in the minister's mind, it's so simple that there's nothing to think about. It's already done, because I couldn't remember when my dear friend's surgery was. She said, I take it as a compliment, you know, you're just that clear, you really get it. So, and the funny thing is that I'm only bringing it up because when you were up here, I went, oh, for God's sake, I haven't even asked you how you're doing, or, you know, I just totally, it is so not on my radar because I just know how these things are, you know, and it's not that I'm intuitive, it's that I know how to work the law, and so do you, and that's why you're here today. So the title of my message is perhaps a little misleading in as much as the title of the talk is something about the lost art of spiritual togetherness. And the truth is, I don't agree with that statement. I don't believe that there's a lost art of spiritual togetherness for several reasons, and we will talk about that. I do believe there's space for us to have an emphasis on the value of spiritual togetherness, and that's how I want to lead into all of the things that I want to say today. So the lost art, as I played just with those little words right there, I was thinking, you know, you don't lose art. Art is something you capture. If you're an artist, if you are a musician, if you paint or draw, or you're a poet, there is something divine that the artist knows how to open to and grab, you know, and snatch it and put it into some kind of form. So it's never lost. I think we can be uninspired, but I don't think it's ever lost. It's always there. And I think that's really what the point of the message is this morning. It took me a long time to figure that out. In fact, this was one of those days where I got up and I went, that talk you wrote yesterday, I just don't get it. And I sort of started all over at 4 in the morning going, what is Spirit trying to say this morning? And so what I came up with is that there are a couple of ways that looking at this idea of spiritual togetherness, in fact, there's more than a couple because that song just touched me in the way that togetherness was related to change. And I think that we're living in times of change. We're always living in times of change. Sometimes it's just more apparent than other times. But what I think we want to look together at this morning is this idea of spiritual togetherness. And I want to say to you that because we come together on Sunday morning and we sit in a sanctuary that has been blessed with so much prayer and so many spiritual messages and lessons, does not make us have a moment of having spiritual togetherness. Just because we're all sitting in the same room, even though we may have come here for somewhat of a similar purpose, does not mean that we can't still be disconnected. And I don't know that we talk about that. And I think I have a beautiful little sort of few steps to ways to find, set an intention and find your way to fulfilling that intention so that you can be spiritually fed and have that sense of spiritual togetherness in community. And this topic interests me a great deal because I'm looking at sort of seeing my own community, my own spiritual community, as becoming this, in my own view, this beloved community. But it doesn't mean we change any. It means that we're learning to talk a new way about how we gather. So the term beloved community actually comes from Martin Luther King, and we'll be talking in little segments about it over the upcoming weeks. But I think that the beautiful thing that happens in true togetherness is that there is a joining. There is some way we find a union. There is some way we come together in relationship. And the longer I study all of this lovely, juicy, satisfying material, the longer I stay immersed in it, the more I see that the entire message is about relationship. So it's not just how you get along with each other, but it's how you relate to life. It's how you relate to the members of your family. It's how you relate to your neighbors. It's the relationship you hold with your stuff. So everything is about relationship, and ultimately, that's because everything is about our relationship with the divine. See, I think we just get each other to figure that out, to sort of practice some of this stuff in our togetherness. And I really believe, along with others, that relationship is truly the soul of the universe. So when clergy get together and leaders of spiritual worship get together and publish books and create conferences about why there's this lost art of spiritual togetherness, I think what they're really talking about is, why are there less people in the pews? And what can we do about it? And what I know is that the emphasis could easily be changed to that which matters most, and that is relationship, and that we all, whether you're millennium and you're not wanting religion, or you're someone advanced in years and you're just tired of going to church, whatever that call is that is lessening the numbers we are seeing in Sunday mornings, I also see that that does not in any way diminish our need to be together, our desire to share community. So the other idea, before I go too much farther away from this, is that the third thing I was thinking that pertains to relationship is ourself. In other words, when we are disconnected, sometimes we get disjointed in our own sense of how we're moving in the planet, right? So maybe we compartmentalize different parts of our life, and sometimes they feel really separate. So I was thinking that this idea of spiritual togetherness might also be applied to us as we sort of pull ourselves together, as we sort of come back to the truth of our being, that in the way that we are created in the image and likeness of God means that there's that something in us that is already perfect, whole, and complete. And I know that sometimes it's difficult for us to wrap our idea around, our minds around that idea, but that's, I think, as we look at relationship in these three different ways, we're going to pull it, we're going to blend it all together, and we're going to have a little more substance when we leave this morning. And so the quotation that I found from the same book that Judy read from, and by the way, that's one of my favorite quotes, wherever Judy is off to. Oh, there you are, darling. Thank you. That was so beautiful. So nice to have you on the pulpit. I always love your voice. You have just a beautiful voice that we don't hear enough. That whole idea of I love how in that quote, because that's really truly one of my favorite quotes. And by the way, that same passage is found in our Science of Mind textbook. And what's interesting to me is I never thought about it before till you were reading it. Oh, the other, by the way, is you must see the back of what she's wearing. It's gorgeous. I see everybody's back, you know, everybody that's impressive. That's a really cool outfit. So what I was thinking while she was reading that, and it never occurred to me before, but Ernest Holmes wrote that book in 1919, well before he wrote the Science of Mind textbook. So I think it's very interesting that some of that overlaps, and we might not know that if we didn't build such a beautiful intimacy with some of his readings and we begin to recognize the familiarity of all that stuff. So the quote that I found in that book, written 101 years ago, Creative Mind and Success, Ernest Holmes, this is the quote I want to share that inspired me for the writing of the message today. As God's thought makes worlds and peoples them with all living things, so does our thought make our world and peoples our world with all the experiences we have ever had. Wow. That's what we mean when we talk about the teaching symbol is an example of how all life came to be, and that there is a way to look at it that in the terms of the story of creation of life, but that we can mimic that. That is how we're created in the image and likeness. We have the same ability to create by using our own thoughts, planting new seeds, and changing the circumstances of our own life if we so choose to. So that is a gorgeous quotation that fits the idea that there's an individual consciousness. There's an individual way we are creating our own world, and then there's the collective way. The way that in community you come together to create something else, something special. And every community has their own sort of personality when you think about it. And by the way, this, I can't remember if I just said, I don't think I said this, I think I skipped this part, but it's coincidentally, the CSL theme, coincidentally, it's always funny, the CSL theme for all around the world that they're looking at for February is this idea of oneness, of joining, of unity. And they word it as seeking the common good. See, we're seeking the common good as we come together in spiritual community, whatever purpose you come for. So we are looking, and this sort of complements what I said last week, but we are in some ways looking to find a better version, to reveal a better version of ourselves. And yet, it's not like we have to, it's not like we're not enough already, but we're always sort of recreating ourselves because each and every one of us has this gorgeous, pure potentiality. We're always creating more because there always is more. That's why we wake up in the morrow. You know, that's why there's tomorrow. And we have this opportunity. So it's not to say that there's not enough, but it is to say, try and remember this, it is to say that there's more, that there's always more. So I'm reading this book. I have on my bed table, I've been reading this book by Swami forgive me, I did it so well at home, Paramananda. Swami Paramananda. I don't know why they have to have so many vowels and syllables, but yeah, those Nanda things. So the Swami was an Indian mystic and a poet, and he has this classic book. He has several, but the one that I'm reading is called Self-Mastery, which is a term we actually use here. We actually have a class we call Self-Mastery. And the Swami is speaking to that very idea of finding that sort of better version of ourself, even though it's already within us. And so here are his words that were written in 1914. 1914, imagine that. The thirst for happiness is common instinct in all of humankind, But everyone does not possess the secret for acquiring it, nor do we all have the power to retain it once it comes, because that requires both wisdom and endurance. So he's not saying you can't have it. He's not saying it's not right there in front of you waiting for you to grab it, to open yourself to receive it. He's not saying it's unobtainable. He's saying that all of us share this common instinct, and that as we gain wisdom, as we practice endurance in our own lives, then we become more aware of it. And hopefully that wisdom leads us to that place of being able to open up to it, to embody it, to accept it, to receive that grace of God as it pours into our lives. Now, I rarely give a quote from someone I don't know well without researching them, because you never know. And so I did some research on the Swami, and then this is where I went wrong. I had all this great, fantastic information on Swami Paramananda, which had nothing to do with what I needed to say. So I had to throw that all out this morning when I realized it, and then kind of put things together in a different package. But the reason it excited me so much is that Swami Paramananda and Ernest Holmes have great similarity, including the fact that they were born about 2 years apart. Swami got here a couple years before Ernest Holmes did. They had very similar, the more I looked into the Swami's background, the more I realized very similar ideas, very similar approaches to spiritual matters. But here was the key thing where I knew this was going to be an important part of the message this morning. The Swami and Dr. Ernest Holmes, before he was doctor, moved to Boston in 1905. They both happened to move to Boston in 1905. Now, that probably was not a big accident. That's not a coincidence that in 1905, Boston was sort of the hub of this great spiritual dialogue, and all the transcendentalists and the metaphysicians. There was actually a metaphysical club in Boston in 1905 that had been in existence for 30 years already. So it doesn't, you know, it's no accident that the Swami ended up there. But the other thing that's interesting is that Holmes was only 18 years old. So he hadn't really, you know, put all these thoughts together yet. And he wasn't there for the same reasons the Swami was. And I'm not sure that they ever made acquaintance. But the other thing that happened in 1905 was that there was a New Thought conference in Boston. So you can see that something was happening. Holmes was originally from Maine. He had just moved from Maine to Boston. Swami had come from India. And so here are all these great people that are gathering together for the purpose of better understanding mental healing. Mental healing, using our minds to help heal what ails us. That all started back from, well, it's the metaphysicians from the days of Aristotle and Socrates and Plato have talked about all of these things, but it was Dr. Quimby who, in the predating all of this, mid-1800s, early 1800s, I can't remember. Somebody help me out here. Where are the 1860, Mark's thrown out. Quimby was going, he was sick. He was weak. And he wanted to get outside and get some fresh air. This is a wonderful story. And he went to get in a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon, so he could just take a little ride in the wagon and be out in the fresh air. And he was so weak and so ill that somebody had to help him get in. They had to scoop him up and put him in the wagon. And something spooked the horse, and the horse took off with Quimby in it, and Quimby had this thrilling experience of being taken away by a spooked horse. And when the horse calmed down and found its way back to town, Quimby jumped out of that wagon, and he was completely reinvigorated. And that, they say, was the beginning of his own process of understanding that how we're thinking impacts how we feel. So there was this whole, he opened this beautiful package of mental healing or spiritual mind healing that then progressed through the years. And by the way, all the great founders of New Thought had some kind of a healing. And that's what drew them to see how it worked, to use it in their own way, and to believe in it. That's where it becomes the science of mind. 1840s, thank you. There you go. Thank you. Right in there. Why did it take somebody so long to think about that? Thank you, Mark. So let me give you a little picture of what was going on in 1905. Civil War was over by about 22 years. Best-selling book of the day was Helen Keller's life story that she published. Mary Baker Eddy, the mother and founder of Christian Science, was retiring. And Albert Einstein was 26 years old. He had just published his paper on the theory of relativity. And Ernest Holmes was 18. And do you know what happened right about that time? We don't know the exact age. They say somewhere between 17 years old and 20 years old. Sources differ. But you know what happened to Holmes that changed his whole life and put him on a trajectory? Well, that was a hard word for me to think I could say. Yeah, that. And that threw him in a new direction. Not yet. He discovered Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson changed his life. Whereas the Swami talks about this thirst for happiness is common to everybody, Holmes knew when he read Emerson that it was like drinking water, that it so satisfied his thirst that it was like drinking water to him, and that he it was a necessity. He loved it. And it put everything he had studied previous to that, everything that had gotten him ready for this great metaphysical or new thought or spiritual journey, it put it all in a new order. And he knew exactly what he wanted to do with his life. He knew that he had to talk about this stuff, and he had to keep learning about this stuff. So in 1905, the world was changing like crazy. Automobiles, there were about 77,000 cars on the road, not many roads, but they still called them the devil wagons. You know, they still were not the favorite. 1905, former President Grover Cleveland published an article in the Ladies' Home Journal, and he had this to tell us in 1905. Sensible and responsible women Grover Cleveland said that sensible and responsible women do not want the vote. It gets better. The relative positions to be assumed by men and women in the working out of our civilization were assigned a long time ago by a higher intelligence than us. In 1905. It gives me hope, I will say this, that another 50 or 70 years that we will also be laughing at some of the things that are printed this day, whether it's technology or Ladies' Home Journal. So today I believe that we are yet again, like the early 1900s, I think that the world is pregnant with change. And I think that's a pleasant way of saying, of course, I'm an old midwife, so that always sounds good to me. But I think it's a pleasant way of saying it because it implies that urgency that something new is coming. And what I want to say is, as metaphysicians, as spiritual seekers or students of spiritual matters, as people who are a part of an organization that is a part of New Thought that happens to still be around, I think the one thing we know is that change is inevitable because we know there are some things that don't change. And what we study, it may not be able to, we may not be able to always see it with a naked eye. But what we know is those things that are unseen are greater than those things that we can see. That there is that power and that presence. I was thinking about, this is a powerful thought. So Spirit created us. I don't care what you call it. I like to call it God. Spirit created us. Some kind of intelligence in the universe that understands perfect order created us. And therefore, by its very nature, Spirit is obligated to maintain what it made. Think about that. And that is why life always provides for us. That is why we speak about being clear and knowing who your source is. That your source is not your bank account. Your source is not your job. Your source is not a loved one. That source of all of life that created us is obligated to see that all of our needs are met. And that's why all of us can sit here in this room today, in this on this planet today, coming from all sorts of different circumstances. Because when we begin to understand that, then we understand that idea of wisdom and endurance. Because it is wisdom and joy and peace and love and order that we do long for in our own lives. And it is the universe, it is God, it is Spirit that is always supplying those things. And sometimes we have to stop and stand and change our perspective in order to see that. It's easy to get caught up in the things that frighten us. It's easy to think that things can, or circumstances or people have the power to take away your good. But they don't. They can make you a little dizzy for a while. They can throw you off balance for a while. But all of us have equal access to that divine order to bring ourselves back into it. I know this because the day before yesterday, I backed into the neighbor's car while I was getting out of the driveway. And I really thought it was the end of the world. I, Miss Minister here, who tries so hard to do good, could not have done that. I was stunned. And I remember, if you were here last week, I was on top of the world. It was like, oh, and I carried that, didn't I, all the way through, Cheryl, all the way through this week, I had that until day before yesterday when I backed into the neighbor's car. And the most interesting thing happened when you work on enlightenment, you notice these things. And what happened was that my head hung low. Then I had to go next door and knock on their door and tell them I ran into their car. Had to be a Mercedes-Benz, darn it. Brand new. It's just a little dent, but, I did it. And I realized I just wanted to cry. I realized that I was embarrassed. I realized that there was just so much shame for me around that incident that it felt like it had taken my joy away. And then I thought, uh-oh, you know better. You always say this, Miss Karen. You stand up here with great authority and say that can't take your joy away. But it did. Sure felt like the joy was gone. And so I came to work and I had a practitioner pray with me. Because that's always a smart thing to do. And I didn't feel better immediately. But what I noticed was I was willing to work on it. Because I didn't need something to take my joy away. I didn't need to ruminate over, oh my God, what have I done? And oh, you're a bad person. All that stuff that normally would rule my life for the next week to 10 days or longer, I found a way to step into something else. And I felt something, even in my sadness, I felt something bubbling and rejoicing in me that said, there is another way. Practice what you preach. Use this stuff and use it now so you don't fall off that mountain, that you don't think you have to give up that good, that you don't think that this, you know, that somebody else has the power to ruin your joy. And, you know, I went to the neighbor's house and only mom was home and she didn't speak a word of English. And I'm telling her, you know, I'm sorry, I just look in the car. And she's going, you know, I don't know. And she goes, move, you want us to move the car? She's saying, no, it's too late. You know, it's too late. And so we're doing this comical thing, this charades. You know, I'm up to the car in the driveway. I'm going, my car, your car, bam. You know, I'm trying to explain to her and the best I can. I'm trying to communicate. We're having spiritual togetherness. And so I came in the house and told my husband and left him to take care of it. And I ran to work really quick so that Cheryl could save me. And when I came home, my husband, there you are, he worked, he had a lot to do that day. I did not write this in the talk. I did not plan to tell you this story yet. So my husband called our insurance company, and they said, oh, no problem. And Hugh got the number, and he took all the information next door to the neighbors. Well, yesterday morning, Papa comes to the door with the daughter, who speaks very good English, and said, he's telling her to tell me, no need, not a problem. He was giving me the insurance stuff back. There is no need for this, for neighbors are family. Neighbors are family, no need. We are called together in spiritual community in unknown ways. And when that happened Saturday morning, I was writing this message. And I just wanted to stop and weep and rejoice and pray and give thanks for the way when I let go of the shame, how quickly the circumstance smoothed itself out. Amen. That's how spirit works. And so I think that it's important to know we have this inner compass. Each and every one of us has this inner compass that will always carry us back to truth. We just have to remember it. And sometimes the hard part is that you have to remember it when you're not feeling it, right? I was pretty upset, pretty quick to beat myself up because I had erred. And what I know is that there's this inner compass, and I believe that's what our spiritual practice is for. It's for us to return again and again to remember that the presence of God is right where we are. That this inner compass then will always carry us back to truth. It will always awaken the inner wisdom in us that knows better. It is an intelligence. It is an energy. And it is the same energy that keeps the entire universe in order. It is the same energy that keeps that fiery ball of sunshine the perfect distance away from us so that it doesn't burn us to a crisp and it yet sustains our life because we need that light. It is the same energy that pulsates through our heart and through our brains that then stimulates an action on our part that then is the energy that moves our hands and that moves our feet and that shows us that endurance comes from our ability to put one foot in front of the other, no matter what. And so we are consciously practicing the art of spiritual togetherness in many, many ways. Neighbors are friends, family, community, as we are. And so I would ask that you question yourself for a moment. What can I do today? Not me, you. What can I do today to become more receptive, more awake, more aware of the presence of God in my life? Last week, I gave you three words. You can use those three words. What matters most? And I think this would be a perfect time to anchor all of these ideas in the words of prayer. And so if I could ask the practitioners and the ministers to stand and to surround the room, we will move into the holiness of the spoken word. Just take a holy breath. Holy, holy breath. And feel the love of God right where you are. Together we know that there is this infinite presence of love. And it permeates this every molecule of air in this room in the same way that it permeates our entire being. Allow yourself to just feel that love within you, the indwelling presence of God. Oh, it is the activity of life. It is the motion of all that is divine. It is that which aligns the planets and heals the body. I feel the love of God within me, and I know it is good. It is that power that is greater than we are. It is that which we can call on when we forget or when we are walking through some challenge or crisis. It is always there. And so with this new intention to stay awake, to seek to see God in front of us at all times, to feel that activity of love moving within us and know that it is divine. To know that Spirit itself is never missing. It is never limited. Our joy is never taken from us. And so let's stir ourselves now. Let's feel that movement within us so that there is that quickening. Because truly, it is a time where this world is pregnant with change. Something new desires to be born on this planet, to emerge in a new spiritual light. And it is love, and it is joy, and it is beauty, and it is a spiritual art that can never be lost. And so, right where we are, there's healing. We've energized the divinity within the cells of our body, and the tissues and the organs in our systems know how to show up in that perfection. Our wholeness is revealed and our relationships are healed. We're able to embody this idea of forgiveness in an entirely new way. And therefore, I know that this day is good. That this time where we have gathered in spiritual togetherness is so blessed. And we do indeed allow ourselves to become that container, a vessel through which Spirit itself can move and express. And that we are a part of the healing of this world. In that way, we recognize that love, that truth, that divinity in each other. So I say thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, Infinite Spirit. Thank you, Life, for all of these blessings, for this remembering that right where we are, we have everything we need. And in that sense of gratitude, with a sense of feeling satiated, satisfied, content, and full, I just release the words of this prayer into that dynamic law that always supports the request. And together we say, and so it is. Amen.